Coming up, Craig Chester joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. It's Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Hi, Dennis. I'm here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Berg.
Hi, everybody.
I'm kind of jealous because your bangs look better than mine today. It could be because I cut mine with a nail scissors as I am.
You did not.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you're ridiculous.
Sometimes it turns out really well. And sometimes
you got to swish them to the side.
Swish them to the side. The thing is, I just got back from Turner Classic Movies. I was in Atlanta.
Yes.
Shooting for something for November about this program I did with Kino Lorber, executive produced Silent Pioneers of Silent Cinema, which is an incredible DVD that needs to be, you can purchase it for your film loving friends
for the holidays. Yeah.
Thank you. And they did my hair so nicely. I tried to get away with one more day. Didn't quite
this
work.
This is where the headphones come in handy.
Yes.
To cover up part, because we're constantly cursing our headphones here because they mess up our hair and they really screw with my acupuncture needles that I sometimes have in my ears and can't wear earrings. There's so many reasons to not like the headphones, but they do an important job.
I like them.
And I know you do. And one of the things that they also do is accessorize one's hair.
Yes. Fit it in nicely. Okay, a couple other housekeeping things,
yes.
Which I have to do. I just did a video for them. You're going to be getting your video, Scarecrow video, in Seattle, Washington. What an amazing site. Check them out. I just learned about them. I'm hopefully going to be going to Seattle, Washington in a couple months. Hopefully it's something is in the works.
You should. It's a beautiful place.
I've never been there. I can't wait to go.
You haven't been there. I'm going there on Monday.
But they're doing a little kind of Kickstarter fundraiser thing, and we're giving away some books.
Nice.
For them, and also
signed books.
Signed books, yes. And not signed by me, but signed by other people. No, I'm kidding. And the Pioneers DVD they will be getting. And then also tonight on Turner Classic Movies, tune in at 5 p.m. here, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. More of Carol Burnett and Funny Ladies. And tonight we talk about Judy Holliday, her insights on Holliday, one of my favorites.
Yes.
Gene Hagen from Singing in the Rain. I'm not sure who else we have on deck, but I'm pretty excited about Judy Holliday. She was actually, I think she was on Broadway at the same time as Judy Holliday, so she had some insights into meeting her. There's no one that Carol Burnett has not met.
Of course.
I mean, she met Mae West, for God's sakes.
No kidding.
But there was no one that I mentioned. I mean, Lucille Ball was her mentor. She's an incredible lady.
So I have a question for you. A lot of times when we are doing the podcast, some of the more interesting conversation happens out in front of snacks before and after
We make our own snacks.
So we make amazing snacks.
Yeah.
Let's face it. People talk about them on Twitter.
That's how we get people here.
Hey there, Marshall Bell. So did you have some of that sort of, you know, casual conversation with Carol Burnett? How'd it go? Not that you can share anything, but like, did you have moments like that where you,
very much
you were so good at that, at engaging people at all times?
Well, you can't not feel happy when you're around her because she's so with it and funny and warm. She's very warm and authentic. And, you know, so you're thinking of all the great skits that have been, that she's done.
Yeah.
And what I always try to do. I'm just, you know, like what she was talking about. I mean, we talked about Roddy McDowall because she was very close. I've read all of her books.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things that always interest me that get her kind of talking was like, coincidentally, right where we were shooting, we were right off Wilcox, which is where she grew up, on Wilcox. So one thing sort of leads to another to sort of set the tone. You don't start in with like, so Tim Conway cracked you guys up. What right. was that like?
Right.
She worked with Robert Altman. We talked a lot about that.
Oh, wow.
We worked with the same director the guy who actually directed Bella Mafia, poor David Green, who I roasted in my book. He was only about 138 when he did Bella Mafia. But he did Friendly Fire with Carol Burnett and Ned Beatty. I mean, she was also an amazing, serious, actress too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she can do it all. And I mentioned her, that was one of the things we talked about, which didn't obviously make it on the air. We were talking about Stephen Sondheim and she, some of the work she's done with Stephen Sondheim. She's a great singer. Her friendship with Julie Andrews. I was saying, we got to get you and Julie Andrews. I'm always like pitching something.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that would be fun. Like, female twosomes films.
Yes.
And then Julie Andrews and Carol Burnett might be good.
Oh, my God.
As long as I'm
amazing.
A part of it.
Absolutely.
Get
right in it.
Yes. And speaking of friendships, coming up today.
Shall we bring him
Craig
in?
Chester. Who I've known for a very long time. We met on an indie film called Grief, which we shot in about 11 hours. We're going to talk about that. I've known Craig and I have had sort of funny parallel lives. Come in, you crazy Craig. I'm going to read your credits, and you have to act them all out. So our guest is actor and writer. I feel like I'm in my apartment in New York City. He's an actor he's a very important person. I'm messing up his intro. He's appeared in such films as Adam and Steve, Kill Your Darlings, I Shot Andy Warhol, and Swoon. I guess he left off Grief, but we're going to talk about that.
Oh, I did. Sorry.
For which he received, an Independent Spirit Award nomination, Best Male Lead. He's also the writer who wrote Adam and Steve, Big Gay Sketch Show, remember that, True Blood, as well as the book Why the Long Face? Please welcome Craig Chester. It's so nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
It's so great to have you here. You grew up, it's so funny. I always thought you grew up in Texas, but you were born in Los Angeles.
West Covina, yeah.
Oops.
That's so.
San Gabriel Valley, not the. Cool
really?
Temporary.
Wait, what's happening? What are you doing?
Sorry, it just got.
Oh, sorry.
This is the correct way to
ask. I'm sorry.
God. That's it. You've already messed up.
I know. I was born in West Covina, California, at a hospital called the Queen of the Valley Hospital, which I think is still there.
Uh-huh.
Jackie Beat was also.
Oh, really?
Yes, we were born in the same place.
Oh, my God.
Which is so crazy. We figured that out when we were doing Grief, which is so funny. But
that is funny. It'll all come back to Grief. But then you moved to Texas. What part of Texas?
When I was 12. Yeah, to Dallas, Texas.
Oh, so yeah. It's a big city.
Yeah, a great place to grow up gay.
Did you watch Dallas at all?
Oh, yeah. But we moved there in, 1978 when it was, huge. I mean,
yeah.
That was, the show.
I had this conversation. Yeah, when I grew up, I was like, that was my show. It was Dallas.
Oh, yeah.
I loved Dallas.
I was obsessed with that show. So we got to move there when, Dallas
was
cool.
Can I tell people's ages by what shows
I know.
What they watch? But
true.
I loved Dallas and JR.
I know. It was so good. It's still good. If you watched it recently, it's really good. It holds up.
All of those shows. Were you into Knots Landing? That was a little campier.
I couldn't get into that. You think I would be because it's campier, but I couldn't get into that.
Yeah, me neither.
I don't know why.
Me neither. But that one had the bigger guest stars, actually.
It did.
Like Barbara Stanwyck.
Oh, that's right. They had the old Hollywood. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Dallas didn't have any. They had Barbara Bacchetti's, but that was it.
Did you notice that every scene was always like someone turning around rather dramatically? It's like, I will not have you do that.
And the shoulder pads on Let's Dynasty is really the shoulder pads.
Right. Yeah. I didn't get channel, as I've often bemoaned. I only got CBS. We didn't have an antenna. We're going to trade poor stories
here. Interesting that would be the one you get.
Yes. Now, I didn't know this.
Indeed.
So, okay, I'm going to get it. I'm skipping ahead because I'm so excited. Do you remember what was the first movie you saw and who took you to see it?
Was it a drive-in? I think it was Old Yeller.
Ooh.
I'm not that old. It was like a revival of old. I mean, it was like a, what do they call it? It comes back around again.
Yes. That was a sad one.
And I think it was a double feature. Either I sort of saw it the next week of Mary Poppins.
Yeah. A lot of people have seen. I skipped that because my parents were hippies. Like, we would not be allowed to see.
Mary Poppins?
No.
That's child abuse.
Yeah. That is child abuse. I agree with you.
My father was very anti. We didn't see Snow White. We were seeing, like, MASH, like Robert Altman, Amarcord.
Well, they kind of paid off. I mean, you've got great taste.
My parents are the one. I've told this story so many times. He took me to a double feature of The Servant. And The Servant is like a, you know, homoerotic. It's like this crazy Joseph Losey. Yeah.
Yes. With Robert Finney? No.
It's Fox. It's the one of the Edward Fox, I think, and Dirk Bogarde.
Okay.
And he plays this, you know, sadomasochistic Dirk Bogarde falls under the spell of his servant. It's very disturbing. Those are the kind of movies that they would take me.
This explains everything.
When you were in elementary school.
Yeah, because they couldn't afford a babysitter, so they would just bring you, you know.
We went to the drive-ins.
Yeah, when we went to the drive-ins.
The first indoor movie I saw was Star Wars.
Oh, really?
I think, or Close Encounters.
I miss Star Wars, too. I was seeing New York, New York, I think, across the street. I was like, I saw that in Queens with my grandmother. And I was like, where are all those people lining up? And
that was
like that phenomenon of that, you know, people lining up and seeing movies.
Oh, yeah. It was first like big blockbuster. Like,
yeah. Dressing up in costume and things like that. So when you're such a great storyteller. Who do you get was your family good storytellers?
My grandma.
So she was.
I mean, my family is mostly women. Like, I think I was the only boy of my generation.
Uh-huh.
Like, all cousins, female cousins. My aunts were not married. They're divorced or whatever. So it was always like, you know, I was around women my whole life.
Yeah.
Surrounded by women. And just, even when my mom, too. Like, whenever I call, it's just like, it's always like, you're not going to believe what happened. Uncle Leroy was here the other day, and he got up and his pants fell down. I'm like, well, did he? We just started laughing. I'm like, did he have underwear on? She's like, I didn't look. It's every time I call them, it's like a story like that. And so, like,
yeah.
I think it's just my family is like, they know that they're performing in a way. They're sort of, my mom's like playing the part of my mom. You know, my dad's sort of playing the part of his dad, my dad. So there's this performative quality to everyone in my family that
they're
sort of like, they're kind of on all the time. And I just was like, you know, a great audience. And my grandma was probably the best storyteller. She had like sort of a wild life. She dated Merle Haggard in the 50s.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, she like rode around in the back of his pickup truck to go to honky tonks. And
my God.
So, you know, there was a lot of that. My grandma was a storyteller. Her name is Gay, too, which is.
It's her
name
fault.
Is Gay. She'd be like, hi, I'm Gay. Everyone laugh.
And your dad, I never knew your dad was in a band.
Oh, yeah. My dad was a lead singer in a rock band, yeah.
I don't remember you ever mentioning this.
That's so weird. Yeah, in West Covina. I mean, my whole childhood, he was like pumping gas at a gas station and like performing in a band. I think they opened for Ike and Tina Turner like a couple of times. But when they were on the skids, like doing Holiday Inns and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, they recorded a record and
And did he play music at home?
Bass. Oh yeah, they rehearsed in our living room. So like my whole childhood was like sitting around listening to this rock band.
We have more and more. You know, my father's ill-fated rock band was 40 Acres and a Mule.
That's the name of it?
That was the name of it. It was. This was years before Spike Lee. They did. That's why I said they did a lot of Stones covers and were mostly Stones.
40 Years and a Mule? This is like a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah, this is my father. This is like, gee, I wonder why it didn't catch on.
My dad's band was called Whiskey.
It's a good name.
The record that they cut was called You Break My Face.
Oh, no.
You Break My Face. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know, song. Apparently.
It was like, babe, you break my face. It was like, I don't know really much about it, but it was that kind of like, I'm mad at you because I love you kind of thing. Like,
and how did your parents meet? Because everything I know about you is mainly with your mom.
Yeah.
And I don't know too much about your dad.
My dad is a fascinating guy. I mean, he delivered. My mom worked at Walgreens at the soda fountain. She was a soda fountain jerk, and that's what they call it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You're not disparaging her by saying that.
And my dad delivered the ice, and that's how they met. He delivered the ice to Walgreens.
Oh my God!
I like that. That's a good meet cute.
It is.
Now I go to Walgreens to get my antidepressant medicines to deal with my childhood. It comes full circle.
Equally sweet.
It all comes. And how did you get into acting? Were you as a kid or?
I mean, I was in high school, you know, just like I had to pick an elective and I didn't know what I wanted to do. My mom was like, well, he likes to watch TV. So acting's on TV, so I'll just tilt. She signed me for theater, whatever.
Right.
And it was a terrible actor. It was a really, really bad actor, but the worst actor in school. I was always getting like, you know, townsperson number two. I was always, you know, sitting on a bench or something. But then, like, when I got depressed in my junior year, I fell in love with a boy, I got depressed, and then, like, I was a great actor the next year. Like, once I got depressed, I was like, oh, there's, like, life is intense and deep and weird. And then I was like, I was really good the next year. So weird.
The leads. Well, you wrote the book, which is called Why the Long Face, which is many years later, but that was about growing up and you had to have this facial surgery.
Yeah.
Which sounds like incredibly intense. Especially for that era.
Well, this is now they can do like computers and they show you what you're going to look like. Back then, you go into the knife and you have no idea what's going to happen.
I'm saying.
You're just like, rolling the dice, hope it turns out okay.
And I'm sure that when you were a kid, it's not like you had a choice. You know, nowadays things get talked over, but I'm sure it's like, next week, we've scheduled your facial reconstruction.
I had like a deformed jaw mostly, and I didn't have a chin. So when I was 16 or so, I think there was a guy in our church who was an orthodontist.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up to me, he's like, you have long face syndrome. And I'm like, what? He's like, you have long face syndrome. I'm like, okay. And then he talked to my parents and he's like, there's people that can help you with that. So he introduced me to this maxillofacial expert in Dallas. Mm-hmm. And the doctor's name is Dr. Sin. We met him through this guy in church. Dr. Sin. And he changed my life. I mean, I had a year's worth of operations. They rebuilt my face.
How many years?
One year's worth of three operations over the course of a year. So it basically was like on the couch for like a year in bed, watching old movies. That was my education to movies. My dad was like, you know, you're going to go to New York and be an actor.
Yeah.
Here's a Streetcar Named Desire. And he always bring home these VHS tapes because old movies. And that's how I sort of fell in love with acting even more. Montgomery Clift for the first time I saw him.
Yes. And so then he's going to play a major part in your life. Shut up. Stop talking. Talk more about me. We're having an in-joke with our own ghosts around. Shut up, Peter, Dennis, Jerry. They're all here.
Getting crowded in here.
And you went to New York City, and we were both at the same ill-fated school. Oh my gosh, they hated us.
Right. They did.
I did not name them in the school. I just referred to them as the acting school that hated me. And then I went to the neighborhood playhouse, and they loved me.
Yeah.
But we both were at the American Academy. They just didn't see 1 ounce of talent in me.
Me neither.
How about you?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, I was like, because part of it is because I was onto them. The teachers, teacher in high school, a very good drama teacher in high school who was no bullshit. She was really, really good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, by the time I showed up and I was like 19, I was very precocious. I had really high standards and she'd have us doing these like sort of pseudo.
Bird, you're a big bird, you're a flapping bird. That I remember that was something. And
your private private space, where like you'd have go in your private space in your mind, and then people would come in and poke you, and you'd be like, stop poking me, I'm crying. It'd be like that kind of like thing where, you know, just trying to provoke you to get you having an emotional response. And I'd be like, this isn't acting. And I just want to be like, you're messing with these kids. Like,
yes.
And I just didn't buy it. I think they could see that. And I still have a problem. I can't hide when I'm not buying something. I try really hard, but
yeah, it was kind of like pseudo actor studio.
Yeah,
and there was one teacher that taught Meisner named Janice Powell, and I liked her.
Okay,
and this was back in the days too. It was so funny. All the teachers smoked in class.
Oh, that's right.
So amazing.
That's right. I'm smoking in the movie theaters. And
did you have a teacher named Ron Marquette?
Yes, I loved Ron.
Crazy Ron.
He was crazy.
I know, he was crazy.
He was such a big personality.
Yes. He was like, he told me that I had a horrible voice, though. He said I was going to end up selling refrigerators, which I don't know what that means. And then the first job, of course, I got was because of my voice.
it's funny because
so everything they said was wrong.
Yeah. Basically, it was like opposite Dan Sesame Street.
Yeah.
Everything's the opposite of what's happening right now.
You'll never work because of that voice.
Oh, yeah. But I had a teacher, I forget who it was, but I was doing a monologue from Spoon River Anthology, which is a big thing there. And she said, you've got to get rid of that accent. You sound like Sue Ellen on Dallas. Had a slight southern accent from Texas, and I'm like, it all comes around to Dallas. You sound like Sue, and it was really like, I'm like, I sound like gay,
yeah,
a gay Texan. And so that got me rid of my accent. I mean,
It did. Yeah, well, that was their, you know, to be, and my famous, I said this in the book, the head of the school's name was Harrietta Peterka. And at the end of the year, I remember, like, you're waiting to see if you're going to get asked back or whatever. And she came up to me in the lobby and she shook my hand and said, "Goodbye, Ileana." And that was a subtle hint that I would not be asked back. Me and Lou Mastillo, who's now on a television
show. The people who didn't get back asked back were the people I see work. I saw working. You know, it's crazy.
And then years later, you know, Harrietta was run over by a bus.
Oh, yeah. She was? I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was on her bike. She got hit by a bike or something. I don't know. Maybe I'm fantasizing.
Hit by a refrigerator.
She was run over. Couldn't see it. Just like she couldn't see my talent. She couldn't see that gigantic bus right in front of her. And I'm not sad at all just saying that. Because I remember how mean that was.
Yeah, it was really mean.
They were a mean school. They were mean, and I didn't care. Yeah. I was like...
Yeah, I know. I mean, I got...
You both got out of it.
Well, it's amazing. So my question is that, again, where does that belief in yourself somehow come from? Even though people are telling you, like, yeah, people told me, like, you have no talent and that voice. But I was like,
I know, here we are. Yeah,
I was like, hey, you're wrong. I'm right. And did you have that same?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's part of it is just like the arrogance of youth, I think, on some level. But
yeah.
But I always knew that, like, I knew I would be an actor. I didn't know how it happened or if I'd be doing community theater. I knew that I was going to be an actor. So, like, when I got Swoon, I just was like, everyone was jumping up and down. Oh my God. And I was sort of like, okay, yeah, that's why I'm here. I'm got to go to work. And
yeah,
I didn't really buy into all that stuff. It just was sort of like, this is what I'm supposed to do.
And you got Swoon, as I recall, from an
backstage.
Does it still exist? I wonder.
I think maybe it's online.
I don't even know.
I don't
but
know.
Back in the day, you actually...
That
was the thing. You looked at... You got little extra jobs and things like that.
I mean, that was a quarter... What happened was sort of like an accident because, like, we made it as a short film and we had enough footage to make it into a feature.
Uh-huh.
So it just sort of happened that it became this thing and it was sort of... Came along right when the queer cinema thing was exploding. Part of that. But so we weren't... I mean, I just thought I was doing a short film out of backstage.
And it was shot in black and white.
It was shot in black and white. Ellen Kuras did the cinematography.
She became quite famous.
She's so good. It was her first movie, her first non-documentary film.
Yeah.
I just was so complete. I mean, it was like 3 months of auditions. It was really
I didn't know that.
Crazy process, yeah.
And
you were partnered up with a lot of different actors. And, you know, Dan Schleckett, who wanted to play opposite me, was the first person I read with. And then three months later, we were back together again, and we were auditioning again.
And it was funny when I did this documentary, which was called Everybody Just Stay Calm, right, about doing independent films. And you told this funny story about working with Tom Kalin because you didn't know any better. He would just go there. And it was like you'd be
in the swamp. I forgot about that. I was sitting on a beehive or like a wasp nest or something.
They were shooting, and you didn't care.
And I'm like, I'm standing on a bunch of wasps. Okay. Almost action. And they're like, I had these like really thick wool pants. I was like, period, 1920s.
Yeah.
And so they were trying to sting me, but they couldn't sting me.
Oh.
But it was crazy.
But, and so the movie comes out. What, do you remember what year it was?
92.
Wow.
It came out while we were shooting Grief, actually.
And it was huge. You were nominated for an Independent Spirit Award, which was a really big deal in those days. Now the Spirit Awards is basically like Oscars. The pre-Oscar.
Yeah.
But back in the day for an independent film, it was especially very low budget.
Yeah.
What Swoon was. Yeah, it was a big hit and really put you on the map.
Yeah.
And why did you decide? Cause I know my agents were, I had done Cape Fear and
I remember that. Yeah.
And Alive.
Yeah. You just come from Alive. I think cause you were really thin.
I just come from Alive. I know that was my goal weight. I love to look back at pictures. I'm like, I look good then. But yeah, my agents were like, why are you doing this gay film? But I met Richard Glatzer at a party and we just sort of hit it off.
Yeah. Richard.
I said, you seem like somebody that would be into Edgar Ulmer. And it was so obscure and he started laughing.
And he was into
Edgar Ulmer. But how did you get into Grief?
I was at Sundance with Swoon, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, there was a lot of buzz around the movie, and so we met. We met at a party, and Mickey Cottrell's annual like gay party.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt was there. He was not gay, but he was at the party and drunk. He's all these cool people were there, and
Back in the day.
I just met him at a party. This is how a lot of my jobs, just like going out, meeting people.
Yeah.
And just running into people. It's sort of like you sort of have trusted that fate would take you someplace and then it would happen. And so I met Richard at a party, and the next day he slipped the script in my box at the hotel where I was at, whatever, mm-hmm. and I read it and I loved it. But he was also offered this other movie at the same time called The Wedding Planner, which is an Ang Lee movie.
Oh, right.
One of his first, I think his first English-speaking movie.
And, yeah.
And part of the boyfriend in that, and I had to make a decision. I met with Aang and I met with Richard, and I decided to go with Richard because I thought the part was better.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad I did, although Aang, I think, did pretty well for himself after that.
That's funny. He was in the documentary, too.
Oh, really? Oh.
Nobody knew who he was.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
But now I look like I'm Sybil the Soothsayer, you know?
You are, well, you know. And I just loved him. He wanted me to play a version of him, so that was... big responsibility in a way, weird, kind of weird.
Yeah, and so we all met. That's how we met. It was on Grief, and Jackie Beat was in the film playing. And now, of course, it seems so commonplace, but Jackie Beat was playing a woman, playing the boss in the movie. And did we take some heat for that? For people thinking he was doing Divine?
I think he dealt with that a lot his whole career, I think.
He's such a good actor.
He's such a good actor. Yeah. He's so smart. And he's so one of the funniest person I've ever met. I mean, just like so sharp. And we're still friends. We hang out. We see his shows.
Do you remember the time we were all in the little Volkswagen going up the hill with Jackie?
Wait, was that my Volkswagen? I think it was mine.
I think it was. We had a little Flintstones moment. I think we were going up Whitley.
That's right. That's right.
We were going up Whitley.
That's where I lived. I lived on Whitley. Oh my God.
The car wouldn't go before we started.
Jackie, look,
there's a picture.
Carlton. Jackie.
Carlton, who is one of the dancers with, he was probably the most famous of us. Yeah. He was one of Madonna's dancers.
He was in Truth or Dare, that was a huge thing.
It was big. But how many days did we shot the movie? In like 7 days?
I think it was 7, then we did 3 bonus days like a little while later.
Yeah, we did the pickup.
Yeah, we just shot that. It's funny because the scenes that we shot later are pretty obvious. Like, they look totally different.
Well, I remember we shot literally next to a generator or something.
Yeah,
like literally there's some gigantic heating unit.
When the fence fell on my head. Do you remember that?
Ooh.
Like a barbed wire fence gate as I was walking in, fell on me and hooked me in the head and pulled me to the ground.
Ow.
Yeah, it was a lot of like, and it was like, is he to go to the hospital? I don't think so. Okay, action. Most of my life was like, alive, action.
I remember that was again where one of the stories was, you know, like, we're losing the light, cry. You have to cry now.
That's right. That's right. Carlton was the one who came up to me and whispered into my ear and told me what. Would make me cry, like basically.
Aw.
Because we were very close.
It was also, we worked with Alexis Arquette, who also was considered at the time very famous.
Yeah,
he was coming off of the, what was the movie, Last Exit to Brooklyn?
Yes, which is brilliant. And I know that movie.
It's a good movie, but
it's so good.
If you haven't seen it, see it, but I can never see it again. It's too, I remember going to the premiere and it's just like,
it's depression mode.
You see all the people that we hung out with.
Yeah. I mean, he was, but he kept falling asleep. We had a love scene. I was like, very excited to have a love scene with another gay man, which is rare.
Yeah, this movie is very ahead of its time.
Yeah, and very.
I think it was like the first gay movie that wasn't like a porno, I think, that it actually had a storyline.
And it was actually like, well, it was about AIDS in it, but it was actually comedy, which is sort of unusual. Alexis kept falling asleep during our love scene. Like, we'd be kissing, and he'd be like,
oh, God, that's
like, not... stay awake for me, please.
And then the movie got into Sundance, which seemed very surprising. But that, again, I have this crazy memory of the snow, and like, we were sort
it
of
was so cold.
Yeah, we were kind of like outside the mainstream. We were so indie, like, that it wasn't even considered to be popular.
People had like a different reactions to the movie, too. I remember people were like, you know, they loved or hated it.
Yeah,
I remember like, didn't you fall asleep like with your coat on or something?
Oh my God! Yeah, that was.
I know,
the...
and, And it was like that dry heat from the electric heat, you know, and it was like you were really, really so dehydrated.
Well, that was like, back in the day where you'd all like 11.
You're crashing.
But I remember not knowing the altitude, and I went out and had too much to drink. I think it was champagne. And I literally woke up with my face on the floor and wearing my parka.
I remember that.
With my hands like still in my pockets. Like my arms were completely numb. I wish I could have had that on video. I remember waking up like, where am I?
I'm because you don't really drink, so I remember that. No. It was funny.
And I remember there was an actor who shall remain nameless, but he hit on me, and I was very excited.
Ooh, is it Brad Pitt?
It was somebody pretty famous. I'll tell you, he was married at the time, so I don't want to rat him out. He later became very famous on a medical drama.
Ooh.
That's all I will say. And it wasn't George Clooney.
That's what
another thing was that you worked with Joanne Woodward. I never knew that.
I did. She's actually, Joanne is the one who told me to pursue my acting career through Backstage Magazine.
Really?
Yes, she... Because she, I met her at Sarah Lawrence College. She went back to school in her 50s to get her history degree, and I thought that was so cool. And I was there. I was a campus wife. I was not going to college. But my boyfriend was, so I was like working in the publications office, and I don't know what I was doing. I was a campus wife. I was 23 or something.
Wow.
And I met her. You could audition for plays at Sarah Lawrence, even though if you were a student. So because there was a shortage of male students. So I auditioned for this play, which she wrote, called The Lover, and I got the lead, and became friends with her and became friends with her and Paul and Donna Clea, and they were like the first famous people I ever met. And so they were really good role models because they were very consciously mentoring me. You know, they were those kinds of people, and it was a great experience. The play was about Alzheimer's, about Beatrice Lilly. It was based on Beatrice Lilly and her gay husband, basically.
Oh.
And so it was really, that's how I got it.
Oh, do you still ever reach out to her anymore?
She has Alzheimer's.
That's too bad.
It's so sad. But she was for years, when I got swooned, she was very excited. And, I had to make the decision about whether I was going to come out as gay.
Yeah.
Not that I would have to come out, I think.
Well, it was in those days, it was a big deal.
Back then, you couldn't. Yeah, it was way before Ellen. And now it's lucrative in some ways. But back then, it was a killer, career killer. So I remember going to her and just being like, why do I, and to her and Paul, and just being like, what do I don't know what to do. And they're just like, just be gay. I'm like, really? Just be gay. Be yourself. And they were the ones, because they were, I respected them so much. I mean, they're amazing. And so that's really why I was like, I'm gay, and came out. And I had so much interesting life and career since I had.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, what would have been the alternative? I mean, because we were out here at the same time, and you're auditioning for television shows, and like there was no gay characters on.
No, they were really flamboyant, or like they were. You know, I was never the right kind of gay to work on television.
Like Paul Lynn.
Yeah, I was like either slightly too gay or not gay enough. Like
right,
somewhere in between. Like
too literate.
Yeah.
And so then after Grief, this was your one title era, Swoon, so, Grief,
Frisk,
and then Frisk.
My last movie, yeah.
And I remember doing Frisk, and then we joked about it because like the budgets were getting smaller and smaller of their movies. And you said, eventually I'm going to be doing home video. And then guess what? That's what everything is now.
I know.
There is no more film,
and
we're all doing web series. And I always think of what you said.
So, yeah, that was a moment.
And what was Frisk like? Because that was a dark film.
Frisk was, I was really into that part. I mean, it was, I played like this, drug addicted hooker, prostitute, basically. And so it was, I'm really proud of my work in that movie, even though the movie is so intense and so dark. And but he was Todd Varro and does a lot of underground films still. Very prolific guy. And that was, we shot in San Francisco, and It was fun.
Those are the days where, like, you're just doing movie after movie, right?
Every year was like, a movie at Sundance every year for probably 7 years. And I was always going to Sundance was literally like,
I'm
going to Sundance.
Remember how fun it was?
Yeah, it was really.
Now when you go, it's like organized. And
it's such a big deal now, too.
Yeah.
Like back then, it was like nobody knew what Sundance was. When Swoon was there, it was like no one had heard of it. So.
Right. Or Grief.
Or Grief, it's true. I mean, it's sort of starting to get some publicity, like Entertainment Weekly did a thing about Jackie or something, or you or something about the movie, and
right.
that being a big deal. Cause it was really...
Well, that's where I met. I remember, you know, thank God I did Grief, because then that's how I met Alison Anders. And
oh,
then
really? Oh,
wow. That's how I ended up, you know, being
such
working
a
with
good movie.
Yeah, working with her. So it was, you know, there were good years. I always, like, I look back on the catalogs and I see the people that we met or...
We really were lucky to be part of, you know, that whole thing in the 90s.
And then we went back when you had your book out.
That's right. You were so supportive of my book because you gave me a quote for the jacket, I remember.
Yes.
And something about, like, if Noel Coward grew up in a trailer park, he would be Craig Chester.
Well, that's good.
That
I like
really
that.
That's a really good quote.
I'd read a book with that quote. That's a good one.
I did a reading there. You're really fun. You introduced me. It was really fun.
Yeah, we had fun. That was another fun time we had at Sundance. And then you did I Shot Andy Warhol too, which is another sort of cool. Some of these movies seem like they're, you know, now that the Sundance Channel, when the Sundance Channel first started, they were showing all these indie movies. Now it's just like, you know, with TV, they don't show the movies anymore. So some of these movies that we did in the 90s are really hard to see.
Yeah, they are. I thought Andy Warhol was actually a big deal at the time. And you'd think there'd be more, I'd see it on syndication, or I get, like, you know, a residual check.
I don't think I can.
For 15 cents, you know.
I don't think I get any residual. All the indies, I don't think I...
But I mean, you know, like once in a while. But I mean, so I was surprised that But I don't see it. I don't see it that much. And it's such a good movie. And Lily Taylor is so brilliant.
And then what was the thing where you went to London and you hung out with Brooke Shields?
Oh, that was called The Misadventures of Margaret, which was never released in the United States.
Okay. But this is, I remember getting, you know, I still have postcards. I keep everything. So I have postcards from you.
Oh, that's
when
so nice.
You were hanging out there. But I was
postcards were nice. Nice to send a postcard.
I know.
Yeah.
But you were hanging out with Brooke Shields.
Brooke and I had the same schedule. We're sort of very similar schedules on the show, the movie. And so she just married Andre Agassi, and he was in town for Wimbledon was happening, but he couldn't play because he had an injury.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of cranky. And so Brooke was like, I was with her all the time. Like we hung out all the time. And I really liked her. Like from the moment I met her, I just liked her. And that was one of those weird things too. Where, like, we're the same age. I've grown up with her. Like, she's grown up while I've grown up, and I'm 13. Brooke Shields is 13. And so I was sort of tracking her, you know, in a way. And so then I got to meet her, and she just was so great. She's so nice. And then I met her mom, and back in New York, we went to see Kiss Me Guido together. So I mean, it was fun. But then Andre and Brooke were having some hard times, and
You were there on her.
I was there. I was a third wheel a lot.
That's that's my favorite place to be.
I'm always like, it's always my part.
Me too.
Yeah, I've never been to Paris. They were going to go to Paris one day, Andre and Brooke, and I was like, I'm going to take the tube down there. And I was like, I don't want to go to Paris and be the third wheel. I want to go to Paris on my honeymoon. I've never gone to Paris. I'm 52. I should probably go soon.
See, you could have been there.
No, but I mean, that was, you know, that was, She was amazing. I love her. She's a sweetheart.
So I never got to see that movie. And then Kiss Me Guido was kind of, again, like sort of a big hit, wasn't it, for the indies?
Yeah, Paramount released it. That was a part I played. I remember I was up for the lead in that. And but they wanted to go in a different direction. So I like, well, what about this other part, this drag queen role? And no one could see me in that part. So I went down to, where did I go? In the Village somewhere. And I got... Where was it? I don't remember. But I had a drag queen make me up and drag. And I like a Marilyn Monroe drag, blonde wig and the whole thing. And I walked across Washington Square Park and dragged. It was winter too. To go to my audition. And I walked in and I was in full drag. And none of the other guys, they were in drag. And I got, that's how I got the part. So
oh
so
my God.
Determined.
Were you sitting there going, this was.
And nobody thought it was funny. Every movie I'd done to that point was like me in a corner with a razor blade poised to my wrist. That was all the parts I played were like so sad. And I just wanted to do something really crazy and fun. That was that.
And then you also did a funny stint on Sex and the City. I'm doing the best of before you became a writer.
I was writing my book at the time and I had not seen the show actually, and I mean, I knew about it. Of course, it was like the fourth season, but and so I went to this. I got Carey Barden offered me the part, so I went to
Carey Barden is a very famous casting director,
and So he offered me the part, this part in playing this clerk in Hermes who sells Kim Cattrall, Samantha, a Birkin bag. And so I went to set, you know, in the morning, like at Hermes, and I'm sitting there and Kim Cattrall's there. And I'm like, hi, I'm Craig. And she's like, hi. And I was just sort of happy to be doing something that's not writing my book, you know, to be acting, right. You know, for a change. And she goes, I'm writing a book too. And I'm like, really, what's it about? And she's like, sex. And then I had no idea who her character was. And so we did the scene, and she was really supportive and super great. And we played around with it a lot. And then it became like this, the Birkin bag thing became like a thing. You know?
Yeah.
But when that aired, I watched the show for the first time, and I'm like, oh, this is good. And like, I totally hooked to the show. I mean, I thought it was, you know, really plugged into it. But I mean, it was.
But that was an interesting moment because you were you thinking about transitioning to writing?
No. I mean, I always think that I was, that's hard for me
like
to.
Like, how did it, you got offered the opportunity
I got the book deal I was at a party telling stories about being gay in Hollywood and like funny stories about auditioning and stuff. And
yeah.
I've never really read any gay. And so this editor was like, will you write this as a book proposal? And I said, sure. So I did it. And then I got this book deal. And I didn't even have an agent or anything. I had to call like famous writer friends and be like, what do I do? And so I got this book deal and I wrote the book and that's how I got into television actually. It was through that book. My book was read by Don Roos and Lisa Kudrow and Dan Pukatinsky read it and they wanted to do a series based on my mom basically and so my childhood. So I that's how I got into TV. That's which is what I do now.
Oh, and what happened to that? Did it get?
It was bought by Showtime. It was right around like Lisa had just done the comeback, so like I was in awe of her. I was obsessed with that show, and so we pitched it to HBO and Showtime because back then there was like two networks you could do something. It was sort of about religion,
right?
We could get away with that without advertisers. So we sold it to Showtime. And then I wrote my first TV pilot, adapted my book, and that's how I got an agent, and that's how I wanted to work in TV.
Wow. Yeah. And so transitioning over to writing, did you miss acting or?
Sometimes I do, yeah. I mean, I did this short film like a year ago that that I think turned out really well. This guy, Jordan Firstman, little things like Kill Your Darlings, I had a scene with Daniel Radcliffe playing a dirty old man who seduces him.
Oh, God.
At a nightclub in the 1940s. So that was like sort of my first part in a long time, I think, was working with him, and he was great too. And I've never really been around someone that famous before, like that level of fame. It was pretty intense, but he was such a sweetheart. Like,
what about Marty? He was famous.
Well, we would walk outside. I mean, Daniel, we'd walk outside, and no matter where you were, there'd be swarms of people around him, like he's the Beatles.
Right.
It was crazy. But that was fun. It was a fun job.
And you met Brad Pitt. He was.
I met Brad Pitt, but he wasn't as famous.
He wasn't
famous.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
He wasn't in full
Brad. Marty and I really hung out. We didn't really go walk down the street together. So.
Yeah, well, Marty was, Craig used to, you know, because I would always have, you know, my friends over so they could eat a good meal.
It's true.
And I always forced Marty to have parties.
They were so good.
And so good. We'd have lots of shrimp and champagne.
Lots of shrimp, that's right.
That was all.
I had Christmas with you guys, too. You know, it was a very sweet thing. I missed my flight home for Christmas one year. And you and Marty saved my holiday. You invited me over for dinner, and I went to. We had like the seafood, you know, and all that. It was really sweet.
But didn't he give you good advice? I forgot what it was.
He gave me great advice, which I don't take. But
oh.
No, I mean he. I mean, I do take it, but he said, "We're talking about me in L.A. and this is that Christmas dinner, I think." And I was talking about how I was going back to L.A. and I was living here at the time, like for like a year, and he's like, "I'm like, I just really need to learn, you know, how the business works." I'm in the business, and he's like, "Don't," he's like, "That's bullshit. Don't talk like that." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You're an artist, and you know," and he talked about like how you know he had demons, and like you know, but process of doing his work was a way of using them to do something constructive and positive in the world. And it's like, if you think of what you do as a business, then the demons are controlling you. And I was like. And I really took that to heart. And the next day, I think I was staying with my friend Dustin. The next day, I came over to where he was staying, and the apartment next door to him was gutted out and rented. And that's my apartment. I still have it today, 25 years later.
Wow.
But yeah, that's it's sort of fate took care of that too. And I moved back to New York.
Oh, see? Yeah. See, so he did. I thought he was very good in terms of work and giving.
He was great.
You know. And then, okay, now we have to talk about Adam and Steve, which was then you wrote. Was that the first screenplay you ever wrote?
No, I wrote a screenplay called Save Me, which Fox Searchlight.
That's right. Save Me.
This development hell kind of thing. It was there for 7 or 8 years or something. It was
yes.
a mess. And then, yeah, I wrote, Adam and Steve, I wrote just because, again, like I've always been doing really serious stuff. I just wanted to do something silly. And mm-hmm. so I wrote that movie, I think, in 3 days or something like that. I was like, I didn't take writing that seriously at the time.
Yeah.
So I was sort of just like, then they just start dancing. Nothing's motivated at all in the movie. and it was back when you could also, like, you'd get $1 million to make a movie with your friends. It was
right.
Sort of, that was, like, the last kind of time
we
could do that. And so, yeah, I wrote it really for me to have a part because I wasn't getting any parts anymore. I was almost 40. And then the director got fired, like, I think 2 weeks before production, and I had to step in and direct it, which I wasn't. Didn't enjoy. I mean, I liked directing, but I didn't like directing myself and acting. And I had to dance and all this stuff. So
I like that scene. There's a funny country western
Jackie
dancing.
Beat. Yeah, it's a Jackie Beat song. So that was and that was like you were in a lot of the readings, the early readings of Adam and Steve playing Rhonda. And
yes, terrific. before Parker Posey took over for me. Story of my life. Story of my life. As has Sarah Jessica Parker, too.
Really? Is that true? Oh.
Yeah, I wrote a project, and they said, God, we love this for Sarah Jessica Parker. Oh. So they got rid of me.
What was it called? Divorce?
It was called Life Without Dick. And it's interesting because there's been similar sort of things. It's about a girl who had no talent except to kill people.
That's great.
And she accidentally kills her. There's a hit on her boyfriend, who's a private detective, and she accidentally kills him, and she discovers she's actually good at killing, so she becomes a hit person.
Oh,
so it sort of has this odd parallel with that show that was out, Barry. Sort of has odd, you know. But anyway, she ended up doing it with Harry Connick Jr., that great Irish tenor. He was supposed to be. I had worked on it. It was supposed to be me and Matt Dillon, and he wants to be an Irish tenor, and he's a hitman, and I have no skills, and I end up doing all of his hits for him.
This is before or after Grace of My Heart?
This is after,
okay.
But it's literally in that same period as Adam and Steve, like you said,
right.
For $1 million.
Yeah.
Get to do a movie with your friends.
Yeah.
But so they gave it to her and Harry Connick Jr. The only person that they left in the cast that I had wanted originally was Craig Ferguson.
Oh.
So when I run into Craig, he always says, thank
it's
you.
Sort of like
you believed
in me. Kiss Me, Guido, the TV series. I think it was my only part was
changed
into an Asian guy. But
I know. And I had not. But I'm friends with Alec.
Alec Mop is fantastic. I love him. He's such a good guy and so talented. But I think at the time they were like, there's already a funny, like Sean Hayes, I think Will and Grace was on.
Well, casting Jason Bateman, I think, as the gay guy, too.
Their Jew
is kind of like, let's sort of make it more like The Odd Couple, where we don't really, he's like a soft gay, as Roddy McDowall would say, which I never really knew what that meant. But he and, he would always say, I'd mention someone, and he'd go, you know, like you'd be talking about Farley Granger or whatever, and he'd go, oh, well, he was a soft gay.
A soft gay?
I guess that means...
Supposed to be a hard gay? Like,
I think that means, like, maybe married or maybe...
Oh,
you know,
like
I don't know. I have no idea. Roddy, what does that mean?
Gay-ish. Gay-like. I know he's here. I'm sure he's here with Monty.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get to Monty. Yeah, before we run out of time.
Let's talk about
your crazy story. Now, we have an interesting parallel, which I did not know about, because I wrote in the book about going to see this medium,
mm-hmm.
and she contacted Peter Sellers, mm-hmm. and he ended up being, he was like my, you know, guardian angel and mm-hmm. talking to me, and she wanted, I had to go back and see a movie, and we all sat and watched a movie while she contacted Peter Sellers, and then he said things, you know, it was like commentary from beyond, and you had a very similar experience. I literally found this out with this very same medium.
Which we didn't, put two and two together until yesterday.
Which we just found out.
Yeah.
And I went to her because of Cynthia Rowley, who's a dress designer. She was supposed to go with me, and then she ended up flaking out, and that's how I met her. But anyway, I had this experience. I didn't stay in contact. But you, you went there, and she contacted Montgomery Clift, and he ended up haunting you.
Yeah, for like a year. But then I went to her. I mean, I went to her. I've never seen a psychic before. So my friend Michael, go meet her. Because I was being courted by Hollywood to direct these comedies and become big budget comedies. And as I said, I didn't really enjoy directing. So, but I needed money. So I'm like, maybe I'll go make some money. And so that's how I met her. But she started talking about Montgomery Clift is around me. I wasn't really there for that reason. Mm. And I have always had a thing about Montgomery Clift since I was like probably 19 years old. First time I saw him in a place in the sun was when I was recuperating from my face surgeries. And I had this visceral reaction to him the first time I saw his face. I had this physical reaction to him. And then I got up and I got scared and I locked all the doors in the house, my parents' house, and I felt creeped out. And years later, I was like, maybe that's because I felt Montu was there. Because, this psychic told me that Montgomery Clift had been around me since I was younger and was guiding me. And we had sort of like the opposite life in a way. Like he was in the closet, I was openly gay. Like, We had very similar dynamics in our personal lives, and so it just I thought she Googled me and she was pulling my leg, and so a very nice lady, goodbye. And a month later I was in LA, and my dad introduced me to this woman Josanne and her husband Sam, because they wanted to get into the movie business somehow, and I was doing it. Just my dad was showing me off, so I just went to this dinner and at Orso, and while I was talking. I was talking about being gay. They were asking me who's gay in Hollywood. And I was like, Kevin Spacey. And they're like, no. Jodie Foster. No. They're like, Clutching Their Pearls is shocked. You know, this is back then when people actually, didn't even suspect that, So, and then I said, it's always been that way. Rick Hudson, Montgomery Clift. And when I said Montgomery Clift's name, this woman, Josanne, just sort of sat up and was like, sort of telling me, obviously he's around you. He's been around you for a long time. She told me a lot of the stuff Reverend Catherine told me in New York. And so it just was like this, like a month apart. It was really, really weird. I mean, I couldn't find a logical explanation for it. So that's how it all began. She started calling me every day. Josanne started calling me almost every day saying, like, Monty's here. He wants to get to work on his scripts. You have to write for him. He doesn't like how he's gone down in history, and he wants you to set the record straight. And okay, so I'm being commissioned to write a script on spec. No pay.
By Spirit.
By Spirit, while I'm going up for these, Revenge of the Nerds remakes movies and like Blades of Glory, so it was a very weird time in my life. But then she started telling me stuff that was impossible for her to know, and I just went down the rabbit hole and I got sucked into it. And I'm writing. I told the story on NPR on this show called Unfictional. And then it won a bunch of awards, and now it was optioned by HBO. So now I'm adapting that true story into a movie for HBO, which is where I'm the central character. Craig Chester is there.
Yeah.
And that's really weird, and I'm so sick of myself.
And you had to sell your life rights.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a good idea for me to sit
down.
Who
represented Monty?
Who represented Monty on the other side?
Is it? Yeah.
I don't know. Who's there a Dallin agent out there? I'm sure there are.
I don't know. Sure.
I mean, he's a publicist, and
anyway, okay. So my last question I want to ask is you're working on something else, which is kind of interesting.
I'm working with Sarah Jessica Parker, actually.
Yeah,
producing this show.
Get out.
it's a show called Meg. I've written the first three episodes, but Sarah Jessica's producing it. It's set in the future. It's about a woman who gets a clone of herself to know herself.
It's a great idea.
She doesn't really like herself.
No, I love it.
And so it's an actress acting opposite herself, and it's a lot of it's fun. It's really fun. Charles Randolph is a showrunner who wrote The Big Short, won the Oscar for that, and some fun people. So
wow, yeah. It sounds like you're very busy. Not too busy to come to my house.
Not
for
at
parties.
All. No, I'm not.
Especially if there's shrimp and champagne.
And we have the best parties too.
That's true. We have to name drop that one of the best parties I ever had was with when I was working with John Schlesinger, and then Richard Glatzer came over with his boyfriend Wash, and at the time Wash, who's now he's directed the film Colette.
Yeah.
But back in the day, talk about underground. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Think male underground films. And that was, everyone was all a titter at the party. They were like, does John Schlesinger know who he's talking to?
I'm sure John did.
He had made the movie Fluffer.
Yeah, he made the Fluffer. He also directed a porn movie in Parker Posey's house, which I never told her this.
Oh.
No. She was making Scream, I think. Scream 3 or something. And, or maybe it was Best in Show, but I was house-sitting for her in L.A. And Wash came over and he's like, can I shoot in here? And I'm like, sure.
Wait, is that that's not the house she had by the Japanese restaurant?
Yeah,
up in the hills?
Yeah, the hills, because it had a great view. And
yes.
So so Wash shot a movie called The Devil is a Bottom.
At her house.
At her living room. It was on her, in front of the fireplace. And I came home and was like, there was these two guys. And
dear.
That was those were the days. And now he's like, you know, he directed Still Alice with Richard, with Julianne Moore, which won the Oscar.
Yeah. So, and
you never know. That's what I love about Hollywood, is it?
I know. You never know. You could, one day they're in a living room, and then those are the kind of things that I accidentally bring up. Like, I know, you know, we were at the same party. I don't know you. Stop talking to me. And that would be somebody like, Jason Lee. Yeah, when you be the, sometimes you run into people at airports.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then like later on, you're at a party, and you're like, no, remember we were in Toronto? I don't know you.
I get really people come up to me and baggage come in, and I get really embarrassed and weird.
You do? I feel like it's a given. If you're in show business and you're in an airport on a plane, you have to go up and I say hi to them.
Yeah. I met John C. Reilly at baggage claim.
See?
He came up to me. So
I tried to talk to William Hurt, and he didn't want to have anything to do with me. And, he was very, very angry. We were both at immigration, showing our visas or whatever.
You have something better to do, but why not talk to William?
He was in a bad mood. Yeah. It's okay. I still respect him and admire him. But not that Jason Lee. No way. I don't like that when people say they don't know you and they've never met you.
It's a power trip.
See if you can find a story where Ileana talks about Jason Lee. We talked about it on the podcast a while back.
We did?
Yeah, we did. Any
opportunity to run him down, I'm there. Because I don't like when people do that.
It's a power trip. It's weird.
Maybe they really
just
don't.
Call them on it. Be like, no, I think they.
No, I kept doing it. I kept saying, no, but we were at the. And he was like, I don't know you.
That's just what it's called pretending. You pretend that you met the person if you don't remember them, and just it's polite manners. It's like,
be nice.
Like, I think the idea is you're at a party, right? Yeah. We were at Carrie Fisher's party. And he doesn't want to waste time talking to me. He's got like, there was other people he needed to talk to, maybe. And
Carrie Fisher's my higher power. I said that in the.
Yes, you
did. I love her.
I miss Carrie Fisher's parties. So, they were the best.
Really? I want to hear about
my
that.
God. Every year you get to see like people like Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson eating fried chicken. It would be like,
oh God,
that's all I care about. Seeing famous people.
Eating fried chicken.
Yeah.
That's your next book. The title. Famous people eating fried chicken.
I'm as shallow as a puddle. That's the only reason I got into show business. Anyway, thanks so much for
thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Look for Craig's upcoming projects, the HBO film I Am Montgomery Clift and the series Meg. And you can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Chester.
Yes.
Mr. Craig Chester. Sorry, at Mr. Craig Chester. And you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, online at Amazon. You can also get the Audible book. Also, like our Facebook page. The website is ileanaspodcast.com.
Yeah, thank you. You should look for our movies. At I did a plug for the Seattle Scarecrow video in Seattle, Washington. I bet you guys have all of our movies from the 90s.
Oh, yeah, really?
I hope so.
Oh, cool.
I hope somebody does. Yeah. But as I always say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. This is the end of our movie for now. Thanks so much, Craig, for
being
here.
Come
back anytime.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.